Great to have you with us. Larry Mueller here, and today is Tech Update Day. We're talking about updating your software on your personal devices and taking your IT questions as well with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. So maybe you could tell us about the trouble you run into when you try to update your computer, or maybe when was the last time you checked for updates on your phone? Beth D'Angelo, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Morning, Larry. Good to be here.
So let's talk about updates to begin with. And updates, it's important to keep your tech up to date. Is it not? And why?
Absolutely. Just like maintenance on any other machine. You take your car for oil changes, you know, every 3,000 miles, you take it in for a tune-up. Machines eventually start to have issues, or the software built into your devices may have vulnerabilities that are discovered after they've been produced. And updates come out in order to close those vulnerabilities, fix any issues with the built-in software or firmware or operating system within the device you're using. It's just generally a good idea to update on the schedule the vendor of your product recommends.
So, and that can be fairly often in some cases, I assume?
It can. So take a Windows laptop, for instance. If you have just any, you know, regular laptop running a Windows operating system, generally Windows produces updates on a monthly schedule. They release anywhere from 5 to maybe a dozen and a half updates for various parts of the operating system or programs that are built into the operating system, like your web browser. Within Windows, you can set it up to automatically update on a regular schedule. There are also some critical updates that may come up what we call out of band, so outside of that monthly schedule. Those are usually vulnerabilities that are noticed that really can cause harm to a machine if somebody exploits those. So those come out sometimes more frequently, or not on a schedule, but as they're discovered and fixed.
What about some of the more, unusual items, maybe a car or maybe a smart home device?
Yeah, generally for like a smart home device, you're going to be updating something called firmware, which is a little bit more on the back end of the machine. It's not necessarily updating software that you interact with, but it updates parts of the software that interact directly with the hardware. So if it's, you know, something like a smart refrigerator or, some other kind of internet-connected device, firmware updates for those come out less frequently, usually a few times a year. It's something that you'll usually get a notification on whatever device that you're using, if it is internet-connected, that you'll get a notification saying that there's an update available, and it'll ask you if you want to run the update. So those are always a good idea, just for making sure any defects that were not initially found in the original manufacturing of the product, if they're caught later, oftentimes can be fixed by these either software or firmware updates.
I'm trying to think, in my experience, the updating is can be, I mean, you just follow what they tell you.
It's just kind of a click-through screen. There's not a lot that you have to do. Sometimes the device will need to reboot itself once or sometimes multiple times during the update process. So the features of the screen that you're using won't be available to you while that update is running, which is why often if you can schedule updates on something, it's great to schedule them to happen when you're not using whatever device it is. So if it's your laptop, you may want to schedule it to do its standard updates, you know, in the middle of the night when you're not going to be using the machine so that you're not bothered by it.
Yeah. So how can you tell whether a new software is compatible with your device? That sometimes happens.
Yeah, that's true. So when you have older devices, especially when we're talking maybe about smartphones, the manufacturers of those smartphones eventually will stop making software updates for that particular version of the device. So if you have like an older iPhone, for instance, eventually Apple will stop making updates to the software that runs that iPhone. So you'll no longer be able to, continuously download those and close any vulnerabilities that are found on that software in the future. And as that gets older and older, software products that are made require that some of those vulnerabilities be closed. And if your device isn't capable of updating to do that, then those newer versions of software won't be compatible with that old device. So it's a way they kind of age out some of the older technology.
Yeah, and it's, at that point, you need to buy a new one, I imagine.
So, yeah, if you've got an old iPhone like that you can't download any of the newer software from the Apple Store on, it's basically they're not providing any new software to that old device, so it's not going to be compatible with anything that comes out now.
Sometimes there are bugs. I'm thinking about this. There are bugs or glitches, you might say, in the new software. So you got faulty software. Is there any way to avoid that, but also not avoid getting too far behind?
Yeah, that does happen. And my trick for ensuring that I don't end up with, a bad update or something that is so new that we're not sure how it's going to impact a device, I usually won't update a 0.0 version of a software update. So when something takes a leap between, say, like normally you've been using version 4.0 or 4.5 and then a version 5.0 comes out, I will wait for a version 5.1 to come out to run my update, because anything that went wrong between the large version leaps when they go from one generation to a new generation, so a full number change, usually within the first couple of minor updates to that, they fix all the things that went wrong in that large version update. So look for a point, if you're getting version 4, get version 4.1 or 4.2.
Okay.
Wait until it's been tested and fixed.
Net neutrality, the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, is renewing debates about net neutrality. And maybe just to clue everybody in, what is net neutrality?
So yeah, net neutrality is the idea that internet service providers should not provide faster service to those who pay more to host their websites out there on the internet. So it's essentially a way to treat internet service or broadband service as what we would call like a common good, that anybody who is accessing the internet, if you're trying to get to site X, that your internet service provider isn't going to slow down your access to site X because that site provider doesn't pay a premium to them. So it's really creating a level playing field for access to internet information, that no company can pay to have their site accessed faster by folks who are getting on through whatever internet service provider they're using. So to not create an environment that certain sites are throttled or that they're kind of put into a bottleneck, so it's harder to get to them if they're not paying a premium.
I got it. And I'm trying to think back over the last, let's say decade, how's the government oversight of internet service providers changed, or has it changed much?
It's changed pretty significantly. Several years ago, this idea of net neutrality was pretty controversial, and some laws were changed that allowed certain providers to do some more throttling of the bandwidth available to certain segments of their customer base, kind of based on where they were or based on how much they were paying. there's now efforts to reverse that and really restore this idea of net neutrality, that the internet is a common good service, and that anyone who is paying for access to it should receive the same, basically the same level of access. Similar to everyone getting on the interstate highway should be allowed to go 65.
Yeah, so an internet service provider, I can see how they could block or slow down access to certain websites or services without net neutrality is basically what you're saying.
Yeah, it really creates more of a predatory environment where it's pay to play, and it really kind of dampens the public access to information that's out there.
Yeah. Mike in Spring Green has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hi. So I just wanted to, earlier you were talking about how you need to change the oil on your car, as also need to update your computer. And I was just going down I-94 last weekend, and the computer on my car crashed on my Subaru. And I lost cruise control, and I lost heating control in the car. And fortunately, I was able to get to the next Subaru dealer, and they upgraded the computer, the software on the computer in my car, so that I could continue my trip. $160 later.
$160 later.
Yeah. So just remember to update your the computers in your car too.
Oh, Mike, thanks for calling. Comment, Beth.
You know, it's really funny how complex our cars have become now that you kind of have to have some computer skills to be able to figure them out. It used to be you just need to know how to use a wrench. So, that's a great point, though. If, you know, an update is required on your computer on your car to run certain parts of the car, I would certainly follow the manufacturer's recommendation for running those updates. It's a good cautionary tale.
Yeah. And you might need to just take it in. Well, you probably do need to take it in if you're the average, you know, like I would have to take it in. I wouldn't be able to figure anything out myself.
Well, I think there may be some like automated updates that it would really just flash on a screen. Do you want to run this update now? And if you say yes, it's going to go just fine. There may be issues, though, where there's a problem with the actual computer within your car that the dealer is going to have to do some work on.
Hmm. Well, Clara Neipert's our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Getting a tech update today from Beth D'Angelo. She's worked in IT for more than 20 years. She's a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She loves to find creative solutions to problems, and if you have one, I hope you'll join in, or maybe an experience to share it like we just had heard. Vern in Eau Claire County got a hold of us. He's wondering if, Beth, if you know anything about it's the year 2038 problem, supposedly, and Vern had something from The Guardian. Essentially, when the year 2038 strikes 3/14/07, whatever, on the 19th of March, computers still using 32-bit systems to store and process the date and time won't be able to copy or cope with the date and time change. Have you heard that?
Yeah, it's an interesting problem, and it's kind of similar to what we experienced back in, you probably remember this, Larry, the Y2K issue that happened around the year 2000 when people were worried about a similar issue with older systems being able to calculate the date based on the number of digits they were using for date codes. And this is kind of a similar issue with it relates more to binary code and how time is translated into binary. Fortunately, it only impacts 32-bit systems, and most people won't know what that is, but it's a much kind of an older type of computing system, mainly affecting Unix platforms, which are larger scale, more on the database end system. So it's probably not something that people are going to be impacted by on their devices or their home computers or, you know, their internet connected home devices, things like that. It's something that's more going to impact kind of older large scale computing systems that run on a Unix base. So real nerdy stuff, but not nearly as prevalent as the worry about the Y2K issue, which ended up not really being a very big issue after a lot of mitigation. So
I remember that well because I was in Pasadena for the Rose Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
There were people, I had some friends who didn't go because they were worried about Y2K, and I thought, well, I could be stuck in worse places than Pasadena.
Yeah, I was very early on in my IT career, and the company I worked for, we did quite a bit of work to make sure that our systems didn't have problems. It was kind of an all hands on deck.
Well, I was glad I went and to the Rose Bowl and suffered no problems. So that was a good outcome. Ruth emailed us a question. She's been trying to update her iMac, but it's taken hours long. Does that mean the update is not going to work?
It's possible that something may have timed out. If there's usually a progress bar that moves along as it's actually doing the update or downloading the update. If that hasn't moved for several hours, it may be that the system is locked up, something's frozen. I mean, I would give it some time to continue. What I hate to do is to interrupt an update in the middle because sometimes that can cause an issue with the system. But I would check to make sure that your internet connection is still running if it's stuck maybe trying to download something and it lost internet connection. Maybe check with another device to make sure you're still able to access the internet.
Yeah. I saw a report from the Washington Post that says internet service providers routinely rank low in customer satisfaction compared to other industries. And I'm not sure why. What needs to happen in order for internet service providers to improve and be held accountable?
Yeah, it reminds me of the old days when it was the cable company that we were always complaining about and their customer service being terrible. Kind of a similar issue, you know, providing a pretty similar utility and internet service. And, you know, I think, you know, all internet service providers are for-profit companies. The more competition there is in the market, then there's more incentive for companies to provide a better product and better service around their product. I think people creating like internet sharing co-ops in their local communities to bring in their own broadband service and sharing the cost of that as a cooperative neighborhood can help incentivize some of the companies that are providing service to do a better job if they're not serving certain communities well. And, you know, I've heard of many folks doing that, especially in areas that the internet service providers don't want to run broadband service to because they're too remote or they're far out or the companies don't think they can make enough money. Complaining to them rarely gets you very far. Sometimes you might get a little bit knocked off of your bill if you've had a very bad experience and you can get the right person on the phone. but honestly, it's really hard when you're dealing with large-scale providers who have so many customers that, you know, losing one or two doesn't seem to matter.
Marty in Manitowish Waters sent an email. He wants to keep big companies from accessing his data online, but many websites are collecting cookies these days. Can you avoid cookies in any way?
You can. If you go into the settings of your web browser, you can actually kind of tailor or custom configure those settings to tell your browser which websites you want to allow cookies to be collected from, or if you want to turn that off altogether, you can do it in your internet browser settings. But there's also another real handy way to start kind of controlling the data that's being collected by companies that provide, you know, applications or websites or services, streaming services, things like that. There's something out there now created by a company called Consumer Reports, which I think most folks are familiar with. They're a very longstanding, reputable consumer protection company. They test products and do reviews and things like that. They've developed an app called Permission Slip, which is a mobile app. You can put it on your device. It allows you to see all of the companies that you're interacting with. You can see what data they're collecting on you, and you can actually decide what data you want to allow them to collect, or you can have them delete your data entirely. So I would really highly recommend looking into an app called Permission Slip to see if you can spend some time dialing in what you want to allow companies to see about your data.
So Permission Slip, and it's from?
Made by Consumer Report.
Gee, I guess I haven't been paying close enough attention to my Consumer Reports magazine.
Yeah, I think it came out in 2022.
Okay. Well, that's one I think I'm going to get my hands on. That sounds like a good one.
Yep.
And thanks for that tip. Ron in La Crosse. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I started subscribing to internet cable modem, you know, higher speed back in 2013. You know, they had a guy selling it door to door, and they first signed up, it was only about, $60 or so. When I signed up, 10 years ago. And then over the years, they increased it, you know, until earlier this year, I was paying over $104, $104.98 every month. But the last few months, my internet service provider dropped my bill by $30 every month. So I'm only paying, you know, a little over $74, almost $75 for internet service and voice phone landline service. Man, I think it had something to do with another company that's moving into the neighborhood, and they want to bury their internet service cable in our neighborhood. I think I added two and two, and I think competition caused my current ISP to drop their monthly rate.
Interesting. Interesting. Comment, Beth?
Yeah, like I was saying earlier in the conversation, the competition is really what drives those internet service providers to, one, provide better service, actual better speeds and a better product, but then better customer service as well in order to continue to keep their customer base. Lowering prices isn't a bad way to do it either. So, yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thanks, Ron. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. That reminds me, his comment reminds me a bit about Netflix and other service providers like Netflix. But for Netflix, earlier this year, they cracked down on password sharing. TVs outside of a physical household were barred from using the same account. I can remember once going on to trying to get on Netflix and realizing my daughter, who was in college, was using it. This was like, I don't know, maybe a year or so ago. But what technology, it's interesting. How the heck did they figure out, or how would they figure out if my daughter tried it again? To determine if somebody outside of a household was using an account.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the things that they do, which is pretty simple, is they limit the number of devices that you can have concurrently using your account. So if you are trying to watch on more than, I think three devices, they won't allow it. But that's only, you know, if you're trying to watch them all at the same time. And Netflix is being a little bit tight-lipped about how they're figuring out people are using passwords outside of the same household. And they say that it's a combination of the user's IP address, so the address that they're assigned by the internet service provider that they're connected through, and then IDs built into the device. It's called a MAC address. So it's a unique identifier for every physical device that, you know, will attach to the internet and location. So, using some combination of those three things, they're able to determine whether or not the device you're watching on is within the same household of the account that's registered. And now I've actually heard that they're going to, in the near future, require you to validate your device. So basically they're going to, if you want to sign into a new device, they'll send a verification code to the account holder, and you'll have to get that verification code and put it in on your device in order to attach to that account. So that's more to crack down on people selling their account credentials online. So people are kind of subletting their accounts.
Oh, man. So what about, could somebody use, someone outside of a household use a shared Netflix account if they use a VPN?
That's certainly a way to try to mask the IP address that you're coming from, so that may thwart Netflix's efforts to be able to identify where you are. That's a hot tip, Larry.
Well, yeah, I guess it's something to consider.
There's always a loophole. There's always a way around. And, you know, that's the funny thing. When you work on the side where you're trying to prevent people from misusing things, the people who are misusing are always one step ahead of you.
Well, I could imagine that Netflix, I mean, at one point, I'm sure they even said, yeah, go ahead and share it, you know, outside. But that came to a sudden halt, and I got to believe they were losing money on that.
Yeah, I read an article about they made this change in South America first, and after they started using this system where they're able to identify people who are sharing accounts, their subscription numbers went up by like 51%.
Oh, okay. That's a lot
so
of money.
It's working for them as far as yeah. recapturing that audience.
I guess so. Mm-hmm. Well, Jim in Green Bay has a totally different kind of question, so let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi. When going on vacation and you want to stop the emails, especially the junk mails, from coming and piling up, how do I do that?
Unfortunately, without, I guess, suspending your email account, there really is no way to stop emails from coming in. What you could do is, you know, if you're worried about people sending you messages and you not seeing them for a particular period of time, most email software clients, so like Outlook or whatever you're using for your email, allow you to set like an out-of-office reminder or basically I'm away until such and such a time and I'll get back to you when I return. But as far as stopping the mail from coming in, there really is no good way to do that.
Interesting story. And this happened years ago, and there's probably a cure for it now. But somebody on campus on Friday afternoon said, okay, I put that notice in that they were out of the office and sent it out to his list. And there was somebody else on the list that was going away and said, I'll be out of the office, you know, and whatever. Anyway, those two kept going back and forth. And so they kept getting the message when they were both gone. They kept getting.
I remember the infinite loops. Yeah.
There were tens of thousands of back and forth.
I remember that happening. Yeah, there's been things built into the system now that don't allow it to happen. It'll only send one. So I do remember that back in the day when that wasn't accounted for, that you could get into one of those infinite loop cycles where you're just messaging each other back and forth saying, I'm out of the office.
I'm betting that the IT Division of Information Technology had to come in to play on that one.
Because, that was likely one of those all hands on deck moments.
Oh, it took for it. It was like thousands and thousands of back and forth emails. Could you imagine? Oh my goodness me! Well, Glenda emailed us. The cyber power box is beeping due to battery needs replacement. It says, "Is this cyber power box accessory, or can they omit it from their system?" I'm not sure what the heck.
Yeah, that's the fiber power. It's what we call a UPS, or an uninterruptible power system. It's a battery backup.
Oh.
Yeah, so it sounds like the battery in the battery backup is dead. So either the battery needs to be replaced, or if you're, you know, if you don't use the battery backup, you can remove it from the system. It's just essentially something you plug your computer into before you plug it into the wall. If your power goes out, it'll continue to power your machine.
But you probably, if you want to keep it working, you need to get a new battery.
Yeah, if it's drained and it's not, it's not holding a charge, then either you got to replace the battery or replace the UPS system.
Cleo, who lives near Oconomowoc, emailed, new to a Windows 11 computer program, how is a notice of update needed received? Could it look like a scam? Do you think Windows 11 for Dummies senior version will be what Cleo needs, going from a Windows 7?
No, if you have an update, actually, it's not going to email you or anything. There will be a little window that pops up at the bottom right corner of your screen that'll tell you that Windows updates are available. It'll ask you if you want to update it now, or if you want to snooze that warning. You can snooze it for, you know, a day, so it warns you again tomorrow in case you forget. Or you can then click on a button to schedule the update to happen at a specific time on that same little message that pops up. So it'll be just a message from the operating system right on your main desktop screen.
Barbara emailed us. She has a 2015 iMac that runs slow. Very slow. She does not have games, but does have Netflix, which she can't watch because the sound doesn't match the picture movement. She does she does backups. Should she take it into a computer dock or just purchase a newer iMac?
Yeah, I always say that computers age kind of like dogs, but it's more like 1 year is about 10 years. So we're getting up there in age for your machine. It's probably running a version of the the Apple iOS that is not able to be updated anymore. It's probably end of life, so you're not getting security updates for that machine. Likely, the streaming services that you're trying to use are pushing through the sound and video at a rate that the hardware within your machine can't handle. So streaming on it isn't going to work real well. Probably time to trade that one in for something new. 5 years, 6 years, you can usually get away with. Once you start getting into 7, 8 years old in technology, you start getting out of compatibility with a lot of the newer technologies that you're going to want to use.
Let's go to Diane in Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Larry. So I just had what I think is maybe a simple solution to the gentleman who's going out of town and is concerned about his email getting cluttered with junk mail. The simple solution is create a new account, Gmail, whatever format you like, and only give that new address to people that you really want to contact you, and then just use that old account to, you know, all that junk mail can go to the old account. And then any time you are going to give your email to a business or somewhere that maybe you don't want to be communicating with them on a day-to-day basis, just use that old original account and let that collect all the junk mail in the world, and then you've got this fresh account to communicate with people that you want to.
What do you think, Beth?
No, it's a great idea. It's just kind of the opposite of what I would call a burner account. If you don't want to get junk mail in the first place, like you said, create an email address that you use only for when you sign up for things. So it's your junk mail account. So anytime you have to put your email address in to create a new login for a website, or when you start a new subscription service, or you want to get that 15% off coupon for Kohl's, you put in your burner account, all of your junk mail goes there, and your personal email account stays clean of a lot of that extra email. So it's a fantastic idea.
Diane, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Taking a look at your computers and everything connected with them, your watch, maybe, or your certainly your phone and all kinds of other, and of course your computer. Beth D'Angelo, our guest, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Leslie emailed us. She says she's heard that you should cover your computer's camera to avoid hackers watching you through it. Would Beth D'Angelo recommend doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one thing you can do to protect your home. I know that a lot of laptops now come with like a little slider bar that goes over the camera. It's just a little plastic piece, so you can slide it shut. So it's only open when you want it to be, or, you know, you can put a little piece of tape over it. Whatever you want to do to cover it up. Generally, if your system is well protected, there's not a real high probability that somebody's going to be able to hijack your machine if, you know, you have all your updates on it. You've got virus protection software. You don't have any, you know, active viruses on your machine. Everything is pretty clean on it. But, you know, if you're worried about your privacy, it's always a good idea to keep those things covered.
We got another email about a Google account. The Google account is up to 70%. How do they reduce that? Do they need to remove photos or old files? What can you do?
Yeah, you can certainly clean up, old emails, old files, old photos. Generally, photos are what take up a lot of space. I know I've had my Gmail account for like 20 years and never deleted anything, so that takes up a ton of space in my account. You can also opt in to pay for additional storage if you want to continue to keep everything that's in there. It's inexpensive. I think I pay $1.99 a month for more storage than I could possibly use up. So it's kind of they used to give you unlimited amounts. In the last few years, they've started to put storage caps on those. So that's why folks are starting to see that they're using a larger percentage of what's available to them.
So for $2 a month, you can solve the problem for sure.
Yeah, you can get more.
Yeah. Peter in Stoughton, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I would say about 3-4 months ago, I did a Windows 11 update, and I'm unable to use my password. I'll put in my password, the same one it's been for years and years, and hit enter or hit select, and nothing happens.
Hmm.
That's not good.
That's not good at all.
Yeah. That sounds like something went wrong when you ran the update, or there's, you know, some sort of issue with the machine. I wonder if my thought is that there's something going on with the keyboard and it's typing in the password incorrectly, and I don't think you can see the password when you type it in. Other than that, potentially taking it into a computer shop and having them do a recovery on the machine, they may be able to get in and reset your password, using an administrative account on it. But I've never heard of doing just a software update or an operating system update that's locked you out from your standard password. So I think you might need some professional help with that one.
Yeah. Maybe a new keyboard, or try a different keyboard just to see.
It's possible that the keyboard might be having problems. So if you try a different keyboard and you type it in and it goes in properly, it'll work. But, that's a long shot.
Yeah, that's a long shot. Probably need some professional help there, Peter. There's somebody to look at the machine. Paul in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Paul.
This is with regard to spam and those kind of things.
Yeah.
Number one, I have Juno, which is an old system for email and that. And when I was looking at it the other day, it had three different choices, and one of them was that it would only add to your email people that were in your address book, which would be a good way to get rid of things you didn't want. And another thing I read a while back was about putting the people that you wanted to talk to in your junk mail file, because it automatically goes there. And then don't put any junk mail in there. Just leave that in your regular. And all the people you want to talk to go into your junk mail file, so you just have to go to that.
Oh, Beth, well, that sounds like it could work.
Yeah, I do kind of a similar thing, not with junk mail, but I create rules in my inbox that send messages from certain senders to a specific folder. So it's people I communicate with regularly who I want to make sure that I see that email and that it doesn't get lost in the noise. So within pretty much any email system that you're using, you should be able to go in and create rules for what happens when the email is delivered. And if you want to do that based on who it comes from or information in the subject or the title of the message, or, you know, if it comes from a specific list, you can have it go to a folder, things like that, just to kind of organize your inbox into ways to see what's important and to kind of filter out what's not.
Yeah. Paul, thank you. Appreciate the call. Bill in Knife River, Minnesota. Hi, Bill.
Hey, I volunteer for a community partners organization in northeastern Minnesota that delivers patients for care, chemo, and so forth. And a lot of them are not able to keep up with the technology if they even have a computer or an iPad or something. And at the same time, the firms, the clinics and so forth that send out notices to these patients, to these seniors, is getting more and more complex. And the older machines, older iPads and so forth, don't even open them. And I wonder if there's a solution to this, or if there's a really reasonably priced, easy-to-use tablet or so forth, or something that would be available and affordable as well to these folks.
Yeah.
I would actually recommend a Chromebook for something like that. You know, it's more like, you know, it's a laptop machine essentially, but it's quite stripped down. It runs on a Google Chrome, like Android platform. It's very simple. It's what they use in most classrooms for educational purposes. When they give kids a machine to take home, they're very easy to manage and simple. So you can do email, you can do internet, you can do kind of all the basic stuff you would need to on a computer without all the extras, kind of cluttering it up and making it a lot more complex. So for folks who are looking for a really simple system, something that's very easy to use that doesn't require a lot of maintenance, a Chromebook is a pretty good option for that.
Yeah, and they're really cheap.
They are.
I can't remember. I think for my daughter Emily had a Chromebook through high school that they were required to use, and it was like $85 or something.
Yeah, they're very inexpensive, and you know, that's one thing that's nice about them. If they aren't working very well, they're easy to replace.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Bill, I think that's a really good solution. Thank you very much for calling. Chris in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to know, what is a good video editing software to use? And I'm using a Windows-based system that it doesn't require a steep learning curve.
Okay, a video editing system software.
So you're looking for something on a computer rather than something on a phone or a tablet. So there's, you know, on the phone and tablet, there's a whole bunch of apps out there that you can download that make it really simple. But if you're looking for something with a little bit more power that you want to use on your laptop, there's a program called Adobe Premiere, Adobe Premiere Pro. It's part of the Adobe Creative Suite, so they make things like Adobe Photoshop and Illustrator and Acrobat, so a lot of software products that I think people are pretty familiar with. Premier is really a great tool. It's quite expensive. It's a real powerful tool, so it might be a lot more than than your needs. There's also Adobe has another product called Premier, which is a little bit simpler, less expensive, more streamlined editing. It's great for kind of digital scrapbooks or video scrapbook type work. So something a little bit lower end from Adobe that's not quite as expensive or professional grade. But there are also, if you're, you know, interested in trying it out on an iPad or an iPhone or a tablet or a phone-based system, there are tons of apps out there for video editing, and there's one built right into the Apple iOS called iMovie.
Yeah, and Trina just reminded me that she uses Final Cut Pro. It's available on Windows and is free.
Oh yeah, Final Cut. Gosh, I forgot about that one. Good call.
Yeah, so Final Cut Pro might be something to look into for sure. Our engineer and tech expert extraordinaire, Trina LaSusa, came up with that one. Oh, and Jill Nadeau, not to be wanting to be outdone, recommends Sony Vegas. It was designed in Madison, Wisconsin. Sony Vegas. Do you know that one? Yeah?
No, I'm not familiar with that one. I wonder, was that done by, I can't remember the name of the company that was bought by Sony. Yeah, there used to be a Madison firm that was producing video editing software, and they were bought by Sony recently.
Oh, okay.
Cool. Sonic Foundry, was that it? I think Sonic Foundry started that one.
Oh, well, Jill recommends it.
Cool.
So there you go. Chris, some options for you there. Bill and Racine, what's on your mind?
Yeah, see, I've got a question. I've got a laptop, a Dell laptop, about 7-8 years old. I'm thinking of updating or getting a new laptop from them, but I'm concerned about the passwords in the one, my old computer, the laptop. Is there a way of getting rid of the passwords in there, and where in the world are they?
Are you talking about, like, cleaning that out before you get rid of it? So that people
don't
get a hold of your passwords.
Right.
Yeah, actually, it would probably be a good idea to have the drive cleared on your old machine before you get rid of it. There's on laptops, it's a little harder to get the hard drive out, but there should be a couple of screws on the bottom that allow you to remove the hard drive from the machine. You can take that out, and really, honestly, the best way to make sure your hard drive is inaccessible forever is to smash it. So
take a hammer to it.
Ensure that nobody will ever be able to recover any passwords or, you know, credential information from it.
Yeah, yeah, makes sense. Bill, thank you.
Honestly, what I do, I take it out and smash it.
Which feels kind of good.
Yeah, it's actually really satisfying.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest today, and she will be with us, excuse me, right up until 12:30. Beth, of course, works for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, and she will be here again, as I said, right up till 12:30 to answer your IT questions. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We've got a tech update today with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And let's take a call from William in Lone Rock. William, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I get a question for the previous caller. She recommended to take the hard drive out and then crash the hard drive. Why didn't she just recommend it to do a factory reset and you could probably could sell it for a small profit?
Well, what do you think, Beth?
That would eliminate all the passwords, any personal information. It would have just been like a brand new computer.
Yeah, unfortunately, doing a factory reset or even doing a wipe of the hard drive using software that does that doesn't actually fully delete the data that's on it. The data that is on your hard drive can't be fully deleted unless it is completely overwritten. So if you are going to use something to wipe that hard drive, it needs to completely overwrite all the data on the hard drive to make it completely non-recoverable. So generally with an old machine that you're going to be replacing, the resale value on that's pretty low. You can actually sell the machine without a hard drive, and the hard drive can be replaced. But I would never sell something with a hard drive in it that stored my data.
Mm. All right. There you go, William. Thank you for calling. Scott in Windsor emailed an earlier discussion regarding firmware updates in which he thinks an important deal may not have been mentioned. In this case, they have a Netgear wireless router in their home. Hasn't been updated in 4 or 5 years since they've owned it. And consequently, it's several firmware updates behind. Well, it may be tempting to jump right to the installation of the most recent one. The Netgear tech rep stressed the importance of following the update release sequences to avoid fatal conflicts. He has a vague understanding of why that might be advisable. Perhaps you could elaborate that.
Yeah, so sometimes when you're going from a very old version of a firmware or a software update to the latest and greatest, and there are several versions in between, going from a very old release to a brand new release can be problematic. It can be really time consuming. And often you'll have to upgrade to releases in between first, so you can't make the jump from, say, like a version 3.0 to a version 7.0. You have to hit several versions in between. So maintaining that schedule and updating regularly is pretty important so that you don't have to go multiple versions between your updates.
Makes sense. Anne in Minneapolis, we go to you now. Hi, Anne.
Hey,
oh, we lost Ann. Okay, let's go to Joe from Medford. Called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering about Social Security system. About a security system like McAfee and other systems that keep computers clean. How much of that is redundant and repeat what your computer already covers?
Yeah, there are certain safeguards built into the operating system of your computer. If you're using a Windows machine, there's the Windows Security Suite that does have some built-in virus protection. It also has some firewall protection. It is a bit more complex to use than some of the packages that are out there to purchase separately. I generally recommend, and I personally use, a third-party application for security on my machine. So I use the Norton 360 product. It works very well. It's pretty simple to use. It's reasonably priced compared to a lot of the packages that are out there. There are also free antivirus, anti-malware, firewall systems that you can download and use that may be less well known, but that do require a bit more skill to, I guess, dial in the configuration of and not have them be disruptive to your system, and also require that you find multiple, I guess, free systems that can work together. So I do recommend adding something on top of what your computer has built into the operating system of it for that additional virus protection specifically. Something like Norton 360 releases new virus protection updates weekly, which is much more frequent than the vendor of your operating system does. Mm.
And Ann from Minneapolis is back, so let's go to Ann. Hi, Ann.
Hi there. Say, this is kind of off of your last comment. I'm just wondering about Android smartphone security, and you know, do we need to have virus protection on our phones?
I don't have any like separate. Well, I run an iPhone. I don't run an Android phone, but I don't have any separate virus protection on my phone from what's built into the iOS. It's an Apple iPhone, so it's a little bit different. As far as virus protection software for an Android phone, you know, likely the best way to go for kind of protecting all of your devices is to go with something like a service like McAfee or Norton 360 that allows you to subscribe to a service and then protect all of your devices under one subscription. So I do believe McAfee has an Android version of that. Norton does as well. So if you're concerned about, virus protection on your devices outside of your computer, I would say one of the subscription services that allows you to install on multiple devices would probably be best.
Yeah, that makes sense. And thank you for calling. Lee emailed us. I think it relates to an earlier caller who suddenly had a $30 drop in his monthly internet. Lee says the FCC has a subsidy of $30 a month for internet under the Affordable Connectivity Program.
Oh, that's nice. I hadn't heard about that. That's, I'm not sure if that's what caused the earlier caller's bill to drop, but nice. I would like to get a $30 drop in my internet bill.
Yeah, me too. I haven't yet.
I haven't either. I keep my eyes out for it.
JW emailed us. They have an old AOL account that they've had for years for their freelance work email. This year, AOL did a makeover, and suddenly they're not getting specific emails from a client who is sending them links to downloads they need to do the work, and it is specific to this one client. They get other emails from him, just not the download links. What's going on there?
Well, that's interesting. So only unable to download links from their interface from that specific sender, or I don't know if it's from everyone.
It's from a specific client, just one client who's sending them links to download they need to work on, but they just not downloading the links.
That's interesting. I wonder if there's something to do with the type of file that they're sending, that something within the settings of AOL doesn't allow that file type.
That's possible.
Yeah, I know that, some internet service providers or email providers have, I guess, like a list of attachment types that they won't allow through their system because they're more likely to contain viruses. Maybe helpful if the person who's sending the messages, if they could take those attachments and turn them into a zip file. And then send it as a zip file attachment rather than whatever type of document it is or attachment it is, that may go through.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I like that suggestion. Nancy in Walworth, it's your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Thank you very much. My question is regarding security that I have purchased for my computer. I have an HP. It's an old one, but I am currently involved with PC-Matic.
Okay.
And I would I was wondering what the lady that is talking about IT, what her, what she thinks of that.
So PC-Matic, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It's an annual that I do for $50 a year, and supposedly it covers all malware and viruses, et cetera. I was just wondering if she knew of it and what she thought about it.
Okay, thanks, Nancy.
Yeah, so PC-Matic is similar to what I was talking about before with Norton 360 or McAfee. There are, countless. Webroot is another one, Trend Micro. There are tons of different providers out there that you can purchase a security software suites from that are a similar subscription service. PC-Matic is a little less expensive than some of the others. I see it is $50 a year, which is a pretty low price. I think I pay $100 a year for Norton. So it may be a good lower cost option for folks.
Yeah.
If you want to look into it.
Yeah. Thanks, Nancy. Appreciate the call. Listener called, couldn't stay with us. He thinks Peter from Stoughton, who can't get into his computer after an update, might try a PIN. Sometimes updates force you to use a PIN instead of a password.
Oh, that's a possibility. If, there's some PIN number that I don't know about doing that for a Windows operating system update, though. I haven't seen that before, but if there was some PIN number for locking the machine that was used in addition to a password, that might be an option.
Yeah, yep, for sure. A listener emailed us, how do you wipe all personal data on a 2010 iMac desktop?
Yeah, again, wiping all the personal data, in my opinion, really the best way to go about it is either with data wiping software package that overwrites all of the data on the hard drive, or removing the hard drive from the machine and taking a hammer to it.
Yeah, that's the two.
You just want to make sure when you're using a data delete program that it's one that overwrites the data, because that's the only way to ensure that that data that was on there previously is not recoverable.
Eric in Madison emailed us and says, as you mentioned earlier, Beth, old PCs and laptops become bogged down or fail to get new updates after a few years. You can extend the life of the device by replacing the operating system with a free Linux operating system. Ubuntu is the most user-friendly. He has a ThinkPad laptop he bought in 2013. He installed Fedora on it and still gets updates and does everything he wants it to do.
It is a great solution for kind of getting out of the cycle of using something like a Windows machine or an Apple machine where the vendor is updating not only the hardware and the software to the point where they're making older machines obsolete a lot faster. I know folks who use Ubuntu Linux because they prefer it to using the Apple iOS or a Windows machine. It's a really stable operating system. It's not hard to use. It will take some getting used to for folks who are generally using Windows or a Mac or an Apple machine. But it's a good option if you want to kind of get out of that cycle of having to buy a new machine every 4 or 5 years.
I want to go back to Apple since I'm an Apple guy, and a lot of people are. And Apple released iPhone 15, and a big change is that these phones will use USB-C chargers, which means that you've got to replace all your darn chargers. Can you talk a bit about the different, and don't like going to chargers that aren't Apple oriented or Apple made by Apple, to be perfectly honest, because I've run into too many that don't work. But it's a kind of an expensive little proposition we're talking about here.
Yeah, I'm kind of looking at it the opposite way, Larry, in that I have so many USB-C chargers laying around because every other device I own uses USB-C. It's really the Apple is the outlier, or has been, historically been the outlier using its own proprietary lightning cable. So the change over to USB-C is really, I think, USB, the U in that is universal. And that's really, I think, what they're going for in switching to that standard is to use a universal adapter that you don't need a proprietary special cable just for this device. But that you can use the same cable with multiple devices. You don't have to carry a bunch of cables with you, one for each. So kind of standardizing on a single device and cable that will work for kind of any kind of portable, rechargeable device.
Suffice it to say, I have yet to go to the iPhone 15, but is there a reason I should?
Unless you need to replace your phone or, you really hate the lightning adapter and you want that USB-C, I'm not one to really jump on the every new version. I don't see the point in spending the money on something unless there's really a big radical change or whatever I am currently using is so out of date that it's not worth using anymore. That really is the big change with the iPhone 15 is going to that USB-C standard charging cable, which I think is a good move for Apple. It's really out of character for them because they're notorious for creating these proprietary situations where you have to use their device or you have to use their operating system or you have to use their software because they want to keep you purchasing their product. So I think this is a good move towards opening things up to make it a little bit easier for end users to not have to carry multiple charging cables for all their different devices.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense.
Yeah.
Amy from Milwaukee emailed us, what do you think about WebRoot security through Best Buy? Is it comparable to Norton or McAfee, do you think?
Yeah, WebRoot is certainly in the same class of security products as Norton or McAfee. I think it's pretty reasonably priced as well. I haven't used it, but I've read about it. I've heard of it. It's a pretty reputable product.
So probably okay to give it a shot.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are your major questions that you're getting these days over there? I imagine with the school year on, there are things popping up.
Yeah, we're real busy as usual. I think a lot of what we're running into these days, at least in the corner of IT that I work in, is many of the large vendors that we've been relying on for years for these cloud services, like our Office 365 and our Google Workspace and all of these cloud services that we've come to rely on over the years, the vendors that provide those are now starting to put caps on what was historically unlimited storage and unlimited use. So they're changing how they're going to be charging us for those services, and they're putting caps on the amount of data storage that we can use within those services. So we're starting to have to kind of rein in the proliferation of data that has gone into those recently and start putting quotas on accounts and kind of lower the amount people are relying on these services for unlimited storage because the unlimited has come to an end.
John has been getting a number of text messages saying with a note that says, Joel has tagged you in a post on Facebook or whatever, and he knows that this is not happening, really. Did his Facebook get hijacked, or what do you think?
That's possible. It's just spam text messages. I certainly wouldn't ever trust a text message that said so-and-so tagged you that asked you to click on any kind of link, because that would certainly be a concern that it's going to install some sort of malware or virus. I'm not sure where that would be coming from. There are, if you get on your Facebook account and take a look at your Messenger app to see if maybe any messages have been sent through it, or if there's any kind of unusual activity on your account to try to find out if somebody has maybe hijacked that.
Yeah. And is it a problem to get that fixed?
It can be, especially if you're not able to log in, if they've hijacked it and changed your password. Facebook doesn't make it easy to undo that.
Hmm. And one more quick one from Laura. She's wondering if you can, if she can install internet herself, or does she need to hire a professional?
These days, it's pretty simple. If you're going to be ordering broadband service from any of the, you know, standard internet service providers, they'll usually mail you a router. So you get a package that has a little box in it that you connect to where the cable comes into your house. And then you connect that to either a wired connection to your computer, or sometimes those routers have built-in Wi-Fi router in them. So they come with pretty simple, easy-to-follow instructions on how to set it up and get it started. But if you're not comfortable with doing that yourself, most of the providers will offer an installation service, so you can hire their technicians to come in and do it for you.
Nice to end on something easy and simple and fun. Thank you, Beth.
Thanks, Larry.
Beth DeAngelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She'll be back. We'll do it again with her. I'm Larry Mueller for WPI. Well, they say that everyone has a story to tell, but if you want to tell yours well, you should probably look for experienced writers to help you out. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Our next guest is Luella Schmidt. She's president of the Wisconsin Writers Association and co-founder and co-host of the Midwest Writers Room podcast. She writes fiction and essays about culture, democracy, justice, and history. And it's really great to have her with us today. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Are you a member of a writers group, or maybe a member of the Wisconsin Writers Association? How's being a member helped you as a storyteller? What questions do you have about improving your writing? We'd love to hear from you. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Luella Schmidt, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Nice to be here, Larry. Hi.
So let's talk about the Wisconsin Writers Association first. A little of their history. Celebrated 75 years in 2023. How did it all get started? Fill us in on some of the details.
Sure. Well, so we were formed originally in 1948 by Robert Gard. He was a very, very in love with the Wisconsin idea, which is, of course, that, you know, education should influence people's lives beyond the boundaries of any classroom. And he was very inspired by such an idea. And when he originally founded the organization, it was called the Wisconsin Rural Writers Association. And almost immediately, there were poets and memoirists, fiction and history writers all expressing an interest. And I think within the first year of its existence, they were publishing and distributing collections of writings. They were publishing and distributing a newsletter and sponsoring an annual writing contest. And so since that time, the name changed one more time, I think in 1956, to become Wisconsin Regional Writers Association. And then again in 2011, finally, we became Wisconsin Writers Association.
Thinking back, as you mentioned, Bob Gard, I interviewed him quite a few times over the length of his career. He was around for a long, long time and did a lot of great things.
Yeah,
man, what a great guy. How many members do you have?
I think we're sitting at around 630 active members right now.
Okay, and I understand it, this membership has grown a lot since 2020.
Yeah, it really has. I think if I remember right, our growth was something like, I think I have it nearby, something like 300% over that period. It was really kind of astounding. And, you know, of course, technology and everyone's comfort with, you know, learning via Zoom really kind of exploded around 2020 because of necessity. And I think that really helped. It helped us reach a lot more people and helped a lot more people participate in the programs that we offer.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. I've interviewed a number of authors in this past year or so. Most of those books were written during COVID.
Yeah. Popular activity.
So the mission of the organization is help people become better.
Basically our mission is to encourage, educate, celebrate, and promote writers. So it's a joy to do all of those things.
It's got to be. So in 2020, the group launched the Wisconsin or WWA Press and has since published a couple of books. Why did you decide to get into the publishing business?
I think it was just a natural extension of furthering our mission and being another outlet for members to have to get their words out there. You know, we really want to be a place where stories from and about Wisconsin can come to life. And so our original couple of published works were, you know, one was Grave Digger's Daughter, which was just a lovely
collection. Deborah Ray King.
Yeah, by Deborah Ray King, a really lovely collection of short stories and her, it was a memoir, you know, of her childhood growing up and, you know, what it means to pass down so many of those traditions, particularly country, rural traditions. And she just made that time come alive. And then the second book that we published was Red Road Redemption by PJ Pamela Fullerton. And that too was her, you know, more rural recollections. Her story, her book is more short stories that are set in rural Wisconsin and feature all kinds of farm animals and non-farm animals throughout, and her just kind of bitter, sweet, and lovely recollections of just the people that populate those areas, rural areas of the state.
Bob Gard would have liked both those collections.
I really think he would have. Yes, I really do. And the next one is we're having another publication that's just coming out next week, which is by a retired teacher, Sue Levy Kies. And her memoir is entitled My Homecoming Dance, Reflections on Teaching in Wisconsin. And so she actually has her book launch is coming up on June 11th at the Platteville High School or at the Platteville Library. So that's very exciting. And she basically weaves together, you know, her own, she went to school, you know, her own high school years there and then later was a teacher there. And so her memoir is just this lovely weaving together of those two kind of stories and what it was like to go there and then be the teacher. And so that should be a great read for
that's,
folks.
That's pretty cool. How do you select the books that you publish?
Well, we have a submissions process, just like any other publisher. Our website is wiwrite.org, and you can submit, see the guidelines, you know, what the guidelines are. We're always looking for, you know, fiction, nonfiction. We're open on genre so much as long as it, you know, highlights Wisconsin.
I like that part of it too, highlighting Wisconsin. Do you have to be a member? You don't have to be a member, do you, of the Wisconsin Writers Association, or do you?
You do not have to be a member. I'd be pretty surprised. It's only $35 a year, so it's probably worth it. But we don't have a rule that says you have to be a member to be published.
Well, let's talk about that. Well, maybe first, just to go along the lines of the books that you're publishing, what happens with the books once they're published? I'm thinking about being publicizing and stuff. Is that on the writer herself or himself?
It is a combined joint effort. It certainly is true that the writer has a lot on their shoulders to get out and promote the book themselves. Nobody can talk about it with as much fervor and love as the writer themselves. But our job is to assist with that, send out press releases, come up with a media kit for them to then use and help, you know, help with back cover blurbs and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Thinking some, I gave a talk once to the published writers for the University of Wisconsin Press about how to be interviewed before, during, and after.
Yeah.
Which was a lot of fun and maybe a kind of an eye-opening thing for a few people. I do about 50 interviews a year.
I'll have to go look that up after we're done.
With authors. I don't know if they videotaped that or taped that, recorded it or not, but it was a lot of fun to do it. I was a lot of writers there. So so the publicist, yeah, you're right about it. You've got to really be a little more than a little proactive on your own.
Correct. Even the big publishing houses kind of expect writers these days to have a website, to have some kind of social media presence that is just a more of a must-have these days than it used to be.
Yeah. So where does your group's revenue come from?
Well, primarily we are membership-driven, and then we also do have we have some sponsorship dollars that come in. We have an annual conference that we do every year that is a significant source of our revenue. We also are, a general nonprofit and therefore get, general donations as well. Some of the programs we offer, there are small fees entailed. For example, we do an annual writing contest called the Jade Ring, and there's, a small entrance fee for that. And so pretty much pretty self-contained funding at the moment, paying for ourselves out of our own programs and services.
So what? Tell me some more about the creative writing program that you have.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a great idea, by the way, to have.
Yeah. So we are almost entirely volunteer-run. And so we have a board of directors that meets, about once a month, and people bring their ideas. And, if it seems like it fits our mission and we have the bandwidth, we'll try to roll something out and give it a try. And we rolled out the creative writing program in particular because there just seemed to be a need for some of those basics, the idea of choosing what tense should I choose when I'm writing? What point of view should I use and why? And, other narrative devices, how to structure your narrative, for example, how to create compelling characters. And so the first run through of our creative program, writing program, went through more of those basics that are good for novices, but also good refreshers for more experienced writers. And then we do have another session of the program running, I believe it's coming up in the fall, where we'll focus a little more on more advanced topics. So,
all good. Luella Schmidt, our guest today, president of the Wisconsin Writers Association. Questions about the association or about writing? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're taking a look at writing and the Wisconsin Writers Association with its president, Luella Schmidt. Great to have her with us. First time I think I've talked with her, with you, Luella. Yeah,
yeah,
you're
correct.
Nodding yes in agreement. I don't think we've talked before, but it's fun having you with us today. Questions for her, or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. The conference, I took a look at the upcoming conference. It's not till fall, but probably worth getting some background on it. Give us the when's and what's going on. I thought, wow, the really good talks and really good information that any writer could use.
Yeah, for sure. Every year we travel to a different part of the state, and this year it's October 25th and 26th in beautiful La Crosse. I can't wait. We have keynotes lined up by Lon Samantha Chang, who is heads up the Iowa Writers Workshop, and bestselling novelist Ann Garvin, both doing keynotes. And we also have a little book club event that we're working on. It's coming up in July, where we're going to try to read the novels or the works of our two keynotes and then get together as members and discuss them and get a little excitement going. At the conference itself, you know, there's opportunities for practice pitches. So, you know, before you go and then can do a one-on-one pitch session with actual agents. There will be an agent panel where they can tell us kind of what they are looking for, what kind of books they're looking for to fill their list. There will be a vendor and a book fair where people can sell their books. Ann Garvin will be doing a masterclass for us. There's opportunities to do one-on-one critiques of your work. As you know, one of the things I am a co-host, as you mentioned, of the Midwest Writers Room podcast, and Ken Humphrey and I have heard, you know, every author that we've interviewed has said over and over again that having a critique group is the single biggest thing that kind of gave them a leg up on their work, because you're kind of forced to share your precious writing with other people and have them do it back to you. And I remember the first time I did it, I was terrified. I mean, I think it's okay to say that, you know, it's okay to say that it's hard, but it's so valuable. And we're going to have some of that at the conference. There will be a publisher panel where we can, their topic is basically how to make it out of the slush pile. And then, of course, full of breakout sessions. We broke them out this year between novice craft, advanced craft, and then a third track, which is marketing and publishing. So lots of really great information.
Yeah, it sounded great to me. Carolyn DePere has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment. I'd like your group to be aware that a lot of us can't read a print copy any longer, and we depend on audiobooks. I recently heard an author speaking about her Wisconsin title, and it sounded really interesting, but she didn't have anything other than the print paper book. And I suggested that a lot of times a Wisconsin author might be reading their own title, so they're not using a separate voiceover.
Yeah. Carol, thanks for calling. A comment on that, Luella.
Yeah, I think, you know, for our WWA Press novels, or excuse me, books, they're not all novels, we have not done audiobooks for them yet. Again, we're pretty new at this and just, you know, bringing out our third title, but I can't agree with Carol more. You know, audiobooks, whether you need them because of sight or not, are just such a great way to consume these works. And so I definitely agree that audiobooks are helpful. It's difficult. It's more difficult. It's another thing we have to learn how to kind of do. You know, it's a different medium to get them out there. but it's I think it's worth the work, worth the effort.
Yeah, there are a lot of people. Jill Nadeau is one of them, who our producer, our executive producer for today, loves audiobooks. And
yeah,
I'm not a, you know, I'm not a great one to for an audiobook. I'd rather have the book and be able to look at it, but a lot of people are. So I'm glad to know you're giving that some thought for down the road. Kristen in Lake Mills. Thank you for calling, Kristen. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I was wondering if the WWA has taken any position or has had any discussions or programs on the AI large language models like ChatGPT and use of those, that new technology by writers.
So we have not had any WWA-sponsored events about AI yet. I will tell you that our director of operations and I both attended a webinar about ChatGPT and how that particular webinar was about how to use it as a writer, not for your writing, but to help you kind of idea generate and help you think through character work. And it's the gist of the webinar was basically, how to learn how to feed it the proper prompts so that you can get out of it what you want out of it. And that was really interesting. And we've had a couple of discussions about whether, you know, how to approach that, if we could maybe ask that individual to come and present for us. But it is a hot, hot topic. There are a lot of writers who feel that even using it to idea generate is cheating. I respect for you if that's what you believe. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of, the most that we've done, I think, as an organization is just say in our submission that, you know, you're not allowed to use it.
Yeah.
So that's as far as we've gotten. But it's an excellent question. It is a hot topic. I came across a meme that I wanted to share with Kristen and with you all, and it was basically like, I want AI to do my chores and my laundry so that I have time to create art, not use AI to create art so I have more time to do my chores.
That's a great one. I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, Kristen, thank you so much for calling. Well, it does sound like it's definitely on your radar, and it's something that...
It has to be.
Yeah, you're going to be... You know... You have a list on your website of a number of writing groups around the state. Why do you think so many people want to write?
Oh, boy, what a good question. Well, I think for a lot of folks, I've read a lot of people who say, you know, I don't even know what I think until I write about it. You know, it's a way of processing. That is certainly true for me. I am about midway through a novel, and one of the things that is so fun to watch happen, I will sit there with that blank screen and the cursor blinking at me, mocking me, and suddenly something out of nowhere that I didn't intend on putting in there will just come to me, and it just takes a shape that feels like it's outside of your control, which is such a lovely and addictive feeling to have. So I think there's something in the spiritual side of it, and there's also just something in the, you know, practical side that writing really can help people process things.
Yeah, I've heard a number of authors kind of say pretty much the same thing, looking at that blank page, and then something pops up. Where the heck did that come from? But you don't ask any questions. You just bang away.
Thank you. Conscious, I shall take it.
So you've got that list. What else are people going to find on your website? And the website, we've got it up on our page, but what's the website?
WIWrite.org. So basically... our member benefits are kind of what you'll find on the website. And so, you know, for members, we offer, you know, a free online Zoom event every month. That's basically going to be something like a workshop, maybe on how to launch your book, or it'll be a night of poetry. We also do periodic Zoom open mic nights. Speaking of which, there will be a live open mic night at the conference as well, which is always a real fun thing to do. And we also have a book review program. That is like one of our most popular member benefits, where basically authors are able to submit their book to us, and we work with volunteer readers and help get them reviews, which is just an incredibly powerful way to increase your visibility. And we also, of course, publish 3 times a year. We publish Creative Wisconsin Magazine. That is also something you can read on our website. And that is a literary magazine featuring writers that are members and non-members, and kind of sharing the latest news, things to be aware of upcoming in the state and around the state. What else? I also wanted to mention another program that we added recently, which is critique group sessions. And so these are basically 6 sessions where you can, you know, join a critique group that is led by an established writer to give and receive feedback. And so it's a great way to practice that. You know, giving and receiving are both really helpful tools for any writer to give and receive feedback.
That is really cool. And you mentioned the membership. What is it? $35, is it?
$35 a year. That's it.
So that's just forego one night out for dinner. And you got more than enough to cover the cost of it. Boy, oh boy. And the Midwest Writers Room podcast, here we are getting up a bit to time, but tell us about that podcast and how's it going?
Good. That was an idea by our former president, Barry Whiteman. And at the time, I think it didn't get a lot of, I think there was just a lot of things going on with our organization, and it kind of lingered and didn't, you know, wasn't really happening. And I couldn't get it out of my mind because I'm a big podcast listener myself. And so I threw out there the idea that I'd be willing to try it. And my friend Ken Humphrey said, I'd be willing to do it too. And so once you got 2 people willing to do that work, then it's kind of, it feels less like work. And so we alternate between interviewing authors and interviewing industry experts, you know, people that want to talk about marketing, book marketing, or people that want to talk about publishing, or things like that. And so it's been really fun to get to know all of these amazing writers. We're surrounded by such great talent.
Oh, I love it. The Larry Mueller Show Book Club. But we go with Wisconsin authors, or the book has to be set pretty much in Wisconsin, we're not going to use it. Luella, a great pleasure to talk with you. Boy, that time flew. Let's do it again. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Luella Schmidt, president of the Wisconsin Writers Association and co-founder and co-host of the Midwest Writers Room podcast. The Writers Association website is wiwrite.org. Great to have her along. On the show tomorrow, we'll be talking sports, take a look at the new women's fast pitch softball division of Wisconsin Northwoods Association, then a documentary about flat track motorcycle racing. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.